white population in general, and that is why people of color are correct when they look a white person in the eye and say, you're racist. Because to be white is a false status. It depends on racism. It is racism. It is racism. And it is through silence that we white people maintain the system of oppression. It is through silence that we are allowed to kill and kill and kill and oppress. Been listening to Press Watch on KBOO 90.7 FM and KBOO.FM to all the ships at sea.
And thank you, Teresa, and thank you for listening to The Boo, KBOO Portland, your community radio station. Coming up in an hour, join us for Between the Covers. Today, Ken Jones talks to blogger, journalist, and author Cory Doctorow about his new novel, Walk Away, that envisions a future where civilians can simply walk away from society and are able to use computer-printed food, clothing, and shelter. But first, we've got Flashpoints coming right up with Dennis Bernstein. Hey, thanks KBOO members for your generous support. If you're not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, unless otherwise noted. The Finance Committee is the third Thursday of each month at 5 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032. 8032 to verify if a meeting is being held.
Today on Flashpoints. Up first, we feature an interview with Daniel Kovalik about his new book, The Plot to Scapegoat Russia. Then we catch up with Uncle Bobby Cephas of the Love Not Blood campaign and a national gathering this week of families affected by police violence. Finally, we refocus our attention on the national disgrace of increasing levels of poverty, homelessness, and income inequality in the United States. I'm Kevin Pina, filling in for Dennis Bernstein. All this straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. And you are still listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, continuing my series on the so-called Russiagate scandal, where we see a lot of scapegoating going on in Russia, them being blamed for having hacked the DNC, the Democratic National Committee, releasing information that would purposefully skew and obscure the truth and somehow change the course of democracy in these good United States. I want to invite our next guest to continue that discussion. His name is Dan Kovalik. He's a human rights lawyer, a teacher of international human rights at the University of Pittsburgh School of Law. He also recently wrote a book entitled The Plot to Scapegoat Russia. It's now available on Skyhorse Publishing. Dan, welcome to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, you know, I want to get right to the meat of this, and that is, do you believe the truth behind this so-called Russiagate scandal?
Well, no, I don't. I think it's hyped. I think, first of all, so what are even the allegations? You got a couple. You got the allegation is that Russia hacked the DNC, the Podesta emails, and gave them to WikiLeaks, and WikiLeaks wantonly spread, I guess, the truth, because no one disputes
right.
The fact that the emails were true, of how, you know, kind of double dealing the Democrats were, vis-a-vis Bernie Sanders, and gave the contents of speeches that Hillary Clinton made to Wall Street. Again, first of all, that no one really believes affected the outcome of the election, so let me say that. I think also the evidence so-called about the hacking is pretty weak. I mean, you might recall, first of all, DNC never let the FBI even look at the computers that were allegedly hacked. In fact, they got a private company to do that, and that's what ultimately the FBI, NSA, and CIA based their conclusions on. And I mention those three only because they keep talking over and over about the 17 intelligence agencies that allegedly made conclusions, again, based on this private company's search of the computers. And in fact, we learned in testimony subsequently this year, in the last couple months, and I believe Robert Perry on Consortium News pointed this out, who's excellent, that it was really only the three agencies and hand-picked agents from those agencies who reached the conclusions about the hacking. So I think they're pretty weak. Also, you know about Vault 7 that WikiLeaks release that showed the CIA had the capability and does have the capability to hack something and make it look like the Russians did it. So I think, again, the evidence is weak, but even if we assume the Russians did this hacking, no one thinks that it impacted the election. And two, it seems like pretty small potatoes compared to what all countries do, particularly the United States, in terms of meddling in other countries.
And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, and that is the voice of our guest, Dan Kovalik. We're talking about Russiagate and the allegations that Russia influenced the outcome of our elections. He also just released a new book, The Plot to Scapegoat Russia, Skyhorse Publishing. Let's do a little bit of contextualization. Love that word. Let's talk about, you know, this country. And maybe I saw this the most because I've spent a lot of time in Canada. And Canada did not have the Hollywood Ten. Canada did not have McCarthyism. Canada did not have a pogrom that accused and ruined thousands of lives for being involved with the Communist Party, or, you know, allegations of such. You could lose your job. We saw how it affected many, many people historically. And then, of course, there's the Cold War, and we had the Cuban Missile Crisis, and, you know, this whole narrative is part of the fabric of the collective zeitgeist, if you will, of this country. How do you view that context? That context, has history affected the ability of the people of this country to see the truth when the word Russia is mentioned?
You make a great point. I would say the answer is no. In fact, one of my favorite historians, Eric Hobsbawm, who recently passed away, a British historian, said that the fear and hatred of Russia is in the DNA of Americans. And I think that's what you were touching upon, that because of the long first Cold War, and I say the first Cold War because I think we're now in the midst of a new one, where, as you say, you know, you had this drumbeat of vilification of Russia when it was in fact the Soviet Union. I think Americans are very easily, almost in a Pavlovian type way, able to be led to hate and fear them again. And I think that is what you're seeing. And I think Russia does present a very convenient enemy, so-called, for the United States, which needs enemies to justify the incredible amount of money that we're spending on the military at a time when we can't even, you know, fix roads or bridges or, you know, feed many children in this country. And so, yes, I think Russia is the perfect demon for the U.S. to try to point to justify the continued eternal war footing that we're on. You know, and I mentioned in my book, The Plot to Scapegoat Russia, that after the collapse of the Soviet Union, you know, we had been promised peace and prosperity. You know, we were promised the peace, so-called peace dividend. Do you remember that?
That
term's not even used anymore. Well, we never got that peace dividend, did we? You know, because U.S.
Some people got it. I mean, if you look at income inequality, some people got that peace dividend.
Yeah, the rich people got it, and war profiteers continued to get it. And why? Because we never stopped the wars. You know, we went into Iraq right away. You might recall in 1990 to 1991, as the Soviet Union was going down. And so now I think, you know, we're in the midst of a new Cold War. It's different than the old one. obviously, because, you know, we have to realize, first of all, Russia is a weaker country than it was when it was constituted as the Soviet Union. It has its economy is about the scale of that of Portugal's. Its military spending is about a tenth of the United States. And in fact, Putin announced this year he was going to cut his military by 25%, is, of course, we're increasing our military spending. And at the same time, there isn't this huge, you know, ideological confrontation between communism and capitalism, obviously. You know, Russia is a capitalist country. In fact, it's a capitalism on steroids, which usually would be something that would be quite amenable to the United States. But again, I think you've seen in the last several years, or more than several years, even before the 2016 election, you've seen more and more vilification of Russia and Putin in the media and by the government. I mean, and let me say, I mean, Putin obviously has his shortcomings, and it's fair to be critical.
Let me just remind our listeners, you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, and that's the voice of our guest, Daniel Kovalik. He is a human rights lawyer and teacher of international human rights at the University of Pittsburgh School of Law. He just recently wrote a book entitled The Plot to Scapegoat Russia. Well, you know, it's interesting because it's also in the popular culture. And I have to say that I was a little bit taken aback when I saw the treatment of Oliver Stone on the Stephen Colbert show the other night. You know, it was almost Pavlovian. You know, we talked about how it's in the DNA, this anti-Russian sentiment is in the DNA of Americans, most Americans. I think it was Pavlovian the way that Stephen Colbert led the audience almost into a group hate of Oliver Stone, even suggesting that there was a good reason for détente with Russia or to understand Russia. Did you happen to see that?
I did, and I'll be honest. I mean, I know Oliver Stone. He's been very supportive of my book, by the way. And I was heartbroken. I really was moved almost to the point of tears for the reasons you said. I mean, they brought this guy on, Oliver Stone, who's won 3 Oscars, you know, who volunteered to fight in Vietnam, let us not forget. You know, he dropped out of Yale, went to Vietnam. This is a substantial human being, right? And he was brought on, and by about halfway through the interview, it turns into really, you know, the Colbert and the audience against him. He's not able to get a word in edgewise, again, to talk about something that shouldn't be controversial, the need to have a detente with Russia, to partner with Russia when we can. As Stone mentioned, you know, Putin in his interviews with Stone often referred to the U.S. as a partner. You know, in fact, Putin has offered partnership at times. You know, again, we criticize Putin for many things, but let's point out the things he's done to extend the olive branch. He was the first world leader to call George W. Bush to offer condolences after 9/11. He offered help in the Afghan operations after 9/11, and he gave help. No one disputes that. You know, and this is what led, you might recall, Bush to said he looked into Putin's eyes and saw Putin's soul, right? You might recall that.
That's true, but, you know, there's a bigger point here, too, which is that, you know, Stephen Colbert and a lot of that liberal ilk, you know, they'll call out the easy dictators that the State Department, you know, the dictator of the week that the State Department is trying to perform regime change again. You know, like they change their shirts, they have the dictator of the week. And but you know, those folks will never call out the dictatorship of Saudi Arabia or name them by name in Riyadh. They won't call out the dictators in Bahrain. They, you know what I mean? Or the United Arab Republic. I mean, whoever the U.S. allies are, they kind of treat them with kid gloves and don't mention them. But if the State Department makes a statement about the dictator of the week, you know, the Colberts of this world are ready to pounce.
Well, you're exactly right. And I do talk about that, by the way, in my book. I talk about that dynamic. You mentioned Saudi Arabia, a great example, not even a country that makes the pretense of democracy.
That's right.
A country that with the U.S. weaponry is now destroying the country of Yemen. According to the U.N., there's a likelihood that 7 million people are going to starve due to the U.S.-Saudi war against it. And how often do you hear about that? And how about turn to our own hemisphere? How about Honduras? Honduras, which after the coup in 2009, which the U.S. helped solidify under Obama and Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, again, I discussed this in my book, The Plot to Scapegoat Russia, they have murdered, the military there has murdered gay activists, human rights leaders, environmental leaders, right? Look at Colombia, right next door to Venezuela. Venezuela's in the news almost every day, right, because of protests and whatnot. Meanwhile, next door in Colombia, which receives the third most military aid of any country in the world, only third to Israel and Egypt, they have a death squad state, which has displaced 7 million people. They have 7 million internally displaced people, more internally displaced than anyone on earth, even then in Syria. And yet, how often do you hear about that? How often do you hear about the human rights leaders there being killed or trade unionists being killed? As you say, and as Chomsky has pointed out over the years, there are worthy victims and there are unworthy victims. The worthy victims are those who are victimized by our adversaries and by our enemies or ostensible enemies. The unworthy victims are those who are being victimized by us, and I would put forth the controversial statement that the so-called unworthy victims that the U.S. and its allies are victimizing number much greatly than those being killed by our adversaries. I mean, you look at Russia, everyone says, oh, look at Putin in Ukraine, look at Putin in Syria. And there the discussion ends, right? I mean, we can argue about what's happening in Syria and Ukraine, but he's not really involved in many countries, right? A couple that people can point out. Meanwhile, the U.S. destroyed Libya, and that happened under Obama. No one said boo about that in this country. We've destroyed Iraq now at least twice over. Afghanistan, right? We're helping destroy Yemen. And again, these are things not worthy of discussion. And there is a bipartisan consensus that that type of intervention, that type of violence, is acceptable. In fact, the only thing that people seem to be okay with, of all the things Trump is